Lest I be thought to be lacking in ambition, I would like to begin by telling you the meaning of everything. And I really do mean everything. And I'll put it in terms that I trust will not only be perfectly understandable, but resonate deeply with you, at least to a great degree. And that the meaning of everything, the meaning of what is, why we have anything at all, cosmologically, historically, and so on, is a matter of intra-Trinitarian love. In short, that the Father has lovingly determined in an unshakable, evidently, clearly unshakable loving determination to glorify his Son in the Spirit. And that is why there is anything. And more particularly, the form, the figure, the reality for our understanding by which the Father executes that loving determination to glorify his Son in the Spirit is in our, again, from our, in our creaturely vantage point, the vocabulary that is most suitable for us, given revelation, is that it is concretely the determination to glorify his Son by way of a bride. And that this is why there is anything. And given the fall into sin and rebellion, as I mentioned at the close yesterday, the wondrous story of redemption being the ordinary context in which we know any of these things, in which we receive inscripturated revelation, and ourselves personally come not only to know such things, but in a mystery of divine grace that overflows in love, to belong to it in a real way, that wondrous story of redemption is subservient, I suggest, a means to the still more wondrous end of the glorification of the Son in the church, in the bride, that bridal, motherly, kingdom, city, temple reality that the glorified church is figured as being at the close of the Christian canon at the end of the book of Revelation. I say that on the front end of our final reflections today because it's important for you to know that as I am persuaded of that meaning of everything, it is informing how I see the location of everything biblically. Everything that the Lord has spoken to us, has done among us, has done for us, does for us still, is ordered to this particular end. Now, I came to this conclusion, which is far from unique, far from my own, certainly, but has an eminent, longstanding, deep Christian tradition, and I happen to think it's also something the biblical writers were onto. Especially in the Johannine and Pauline writings. But I've come to this kicking and screaming, as it were, not in fact inclined to conclude this at all, but to maybe frame things in other terms. But what has driven me to this is, in fact, the work that Bill was mentioning just moments ago in the Lydia Center for Women and Families, work on the theological ontology and orientation of gender. Biblically, the meaningfulness of male and female has driven me to appreciate the eschatological ultimacy of the glory of the church captured by the feminine in that relationship, as it drives ethical material in Scripture. That ethical material driven as it is by narratives such as the ones we have been considering. Now, that's another study day or 20. But I mention that as a way of perhaps contextualizing some of where I am asking us to go in our thinking about possibilities canonically for the reverberations of our material. Eve, Tamar, and beyond. In this case, the beyond I have in view is the beyond Genesis 38 as such, but not leaving Genesis 38 at all, but continuing in a refreshed way to read, to read, to reread more deeply, more thickly, if you will, more wisely, the same words, but in the ever-growing context of the Christian canon and our grasp, our understanding of the person and work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So beyond without departure, if you will. And as we make our way down that path, my leading observation for us to consider is that the Holy Spirit regularly inspires details, the very details we were struggling with yesterday at the level of a concept, what to do with all the stuff, the details, the furniture in the room. The Holy Spirit regularly inspires details in the biblical Old Testament narratives whose significance is not to be located or to be grasped, to be identified fully in the immediate narrative itself, but in its repetitions later, its reverberations later, in other ordinarily later, sometimes far later passages that same Spirit inspires elsewhere. That single authorship of the divine Spirit is consistent with himself even where passages are not saying everything inside themselves. And sometimes it's not merely a later passage in relationship to an earlier one. It is instead, to touch on the imagery of the New Testament writers, the very world of the gospel itself, inaugurated in the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ, that is a hermeneutical world as well, where those details of the ancients begin to disclose their importance only from the view provided by the end. And this, in fact, is a chief feature of the biblical hermeneutic. And that is that it is teleological. The end, and I have given you the meaning of all things in light of the end, yeah? The end illuminates the meaning of all things prior to and preliminary to that end. In many respects, it is only from the perspective of the end that we will begin seriously to appreciate the why and not just the what of all of that stuff beforehand. As I suggested yesterday, we are still very, very much on our way to understanding these things. That the end has dawned does not mean it has come in its fullness. And hermeneutically, as a matter of the sanctification of the church's understanding of Scripture, hermeneutically, we too are very much on our way. There is a host of details, of particulars in biblical revelation, whose importance, whose significance, we understand only very weakly and very faintly, or not at all, but will one day understand properly and beautifully. By faith, rather than by sight, we press on, confident the Lord wastes no words, even while we don't yet know what all the words are there for. The end illuminates the meanings of things that come before it. What difference might that make in our Christian reading of Genesis 38? Well, yesterday we noted, we focused a lot of our attention on the unity, made a case for the unity of Genesis 38 with Genesis 37 to 50, the overall Joseph narrative. That even though, as many scholars have thought, the Tamar and Judah narrative seems just dropped down a chapter into the Joseph story, just as things are getting quite stressful, and then seems a foreign body requiring immediate removal, as you could take it right back out and have a seamless Joseph narrative unaffected by the chapter at all. But we made a case instead that Tamar and Judah in Genesis 38 functions as a type scene. It's not that every individual feature that is an abstraction functions typologically. In fact, that's not how types typically work biblically, but that as they form part of a scene, as they are furniture in a particular room, where the room is duplicated, even if every piece of furniture is not replicated, many pieces will be, and we realize we're talking about the same interior designer after all. And so in many respects, that's what we argued with respect to the micro story in Genesis 38, as it is duplicated, replicated in the large scale story of Joseph. In Genesis 37, we noted, after selling Joseph, according to the proposition of Judah, 37, 26, and 27, the brothers take Joseph's tunic and dip it in the blood of a goat, we noted, and send it to their father Jacob. They say, Amar, to Jacob, please recognize, please, whether it is your son's tunic, coat, or not. And he recognized it and said, in verses 32 and 33, what he goes on to say by way of grievous reply. As we noted, this deception echoes in Tamar's plot, her scheme in Genesis 38, and in precisely the same order. I've not read out the Hebrew this morning, but the Hebrew, not just my English themes, are repeated in exactly the same order. Judah, the leader of the brothers in selling Joseph, probably also in deceiving his father, is the main character with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. But in this chapter, chapter 38, we noted the tables are turned. Now it's Judah's turn. Tamar pretends, or at least allows herself to be confused with being a prostitute, to entice her father-in-law, Judah, and secure her rights from him that he has refused her, exacts the pledge of his seal, cord, and staff, which are to be redeemed by the reappearance of that young goat. Hebrew is identical from chapter 37. After succeeding in enticing Judah, she disappears with Judah's seal cord and staff. And then a few months later, when she is found pregnant and about to be burned as punishment, she, same Hebrew word, sends a message with the pledge to her father-in-law Judah, saying, same expression, recognize, please, same expression in Hebrew, to whom these seal, cord, and staff belong. Judah recognizes and says, same Hebrew expression, says she is more righteous than he. There are two episodes then. Judah and his brothers versus Jacob in the big story, Tamar versus Judah in the small one. And the small one is a reversal of the big one, at least as it's been told so far in Genesis, as the deceiver is now deceived. Well, these parallels confirm a relationship between chapter 38 and the surrounding narrative. They indicate the interconnectedness, the unity of the passages. And for most scholars, that's as far as they need to go. They're not particularly interested in why, beyond literary, maybe reconstructive scholarly interests, but not as interested in why on Christian terms it would be important for us to note such a relationship. But at least we can conclude there is one, a relationship. That Genesis 38 is not heterogeneous material, but an integral part of the Joseph story, but in a way we'll learn today that forces us to redefine the Joseph story as actually Judah's story. We can say at least to this point that without the benefit of Genesis 38, the main storyline, the main themes of the Joseph story would falter. Something that is further confirmed for us when we note the real boundary of the Joseph story and the literary structure of the Joseph story as a whole. Which is to say, once we are sensitive to how God has given his people his word in this example, we don't merely satisfy ourselves having discovered or concluded, yeah, this really is how it should be. But the present form of the text should be cherished. In your outline, you see a bit of material for you there regarding the literary boundary of Joseph's story. Very briefly, my observations here are not only that the literary boundary, where we set the beginning and end, open and close of Joseph's story is important for how we read chapter 38, but that it sets us up to appreciate the overall structure of the passage. Very briefly, most scholars say that Genesis 37:2 clearly begins the new section. It's our next toledot, right? In Genesis, we know this is hugely important as a structuring device. See, we all believe in structuring devices to some extent. We know toledotes are there for a reason, yeah? So this starts the new section. It is the toledot of Jacob, hence the title for our conference, Jacob's Sons, 37, verse 2. Where does it close, however? Well, most will say Genesis 50, verse 26 closes the Joseph cycle, if you will, the Joseph toledot. That's the very last of Joseph's activity. He has his last will, records his death. But that would be a departure from all the other examples within Genesis of the toledot structure. The Genesis toledot generations pattern closes in each case with mention of the descendants. Look at Noah in Genesis 10, of Shem in Genesis 11, Terah in connection with Abraham and Isaac in Genesis 25. The passages I list there for you, Isaac, and so on. Given the way Genesis works, it would appear our expectation is that Jacob's toledot is going to close with his descendants as well. That's something given to us in chapter 46, verses 8 to 27, the 12 sons of Jacob. Well, we all know how hugely important it is that we are introduced to the specific combination of the 12 sons of Jacob. This is going to be Israel from this point forward for a great deal of time and theologically far beyond the historical separation of the kingdoms and so on. 12 sons of Jacob, in many ways, this is what we've been waiting for, what Genesis has been preparing us for when we finally get through the generations to the point when Israel is what we recognize Israel to be. That happens at the close of Jacob's toledot section and the close of the Joseph narrative there in chapter 46. What we have afterwards then is kind of classic ancient Hebrew wrapping up material that's more than simply closing the story, but providing further evidence of an assessment of Joseph's life. So the material regarding last will and death is not throwaway material at all, but in a way not unlike Moses' death will be recorded. There's almost a sealing of Joseph's importance that takes place in these last words. But I mention all this about literary boundaries because it means that when we're looking for the structure of the Joseph story, we now know where to start and end our search. Look then, if you would please, at the literary structure outline in chiastic form that I've provided for you on the front page. This is by J.G. Kim. It is the one I'm most persuaded of out of scores of options that I have seen, which is only a small fraction, I'm sure, of the number of proposed ways of outlining Joseph's story. But it's most persuasive not because it confirms my reading of Genesis 38, but quite in reverse. It helped me on its own to persuade me that we should make sure to pay attention in a special way to what's happening in Genesis 38. Now, there's something we should notice at the outset and say something about. You'll notice that in this chiasm, and a chiasm, as you know very well, is a literary device, a structuring device of text, in which the center is like your mountain peak, if you will, of the passage, the thematic center and point of emphasis. And on both sides, before and after that center mountain peak, like the sides of a mountain itself or a perfect triangle, you have descending stages that are parallel to one another and mutually reinforcing or interpretive. Now, when some look at a chiasm like this, they ask a question that I believe is altogether appropriate. Appropriate. Is this not simply a fanciful creation of biblical scholars with far too much time on their hands? And let me say on behalf, I hope, of everyone who is at least trying to be serious about doing justice to biblical texts and biblical scholarship, a lot of times, yes. A lot of times it seems like that may be true. I don't want to overread motives, but I'll put it this way. Not all chiasms are created equal. They need to be justified, but they are also far more than merely an interesting literary tool. for our purposes, notice the parallel we're most interested in. That's D on the front end, and then D with the stroke on the bottom end. You'll see that's where we have chapter 38, the passage regarding Judah and Tamar on the front end. It's called by Kim Judah's experience, which is a very kind and gentle way of describing it. Judah's experience, Genesis 38. On the far end, the parallel passage is called Judah's character transformation. In chapter 44, part of the Joseph narrative, 44, 18 to 34, I am persuaded that is sound. That is, in fact, a parallel. Now, something more to say then about chiasms. Chiasms, as I suggested, can be fanciful rather than genuine. And so, despite the fact I want you to take one seriously today, I want to encourage you in your suspicion of chiasms. But encourage you not to end with suspicion, but to go further, investigate, look for documentation, learn what a chiasm is, and then look for what would suggest its real presence or not. And the reason for that is this. I mentioned yesterday a great deal of work that's been done over the decades on biblical storytelling, ancient Hebrew writing in particular, and a lot of genuine insights we must glean from this excellent scholarship. Here's one of the things we discover that is practically unassailable at this point as a conclusion. Chiasms are real in the text. They're not limited to certain proverbs that are obviously structured this way, or shorter psalms that are obviously structured this way. They reflect, in fact, how many stories and other genres are structured. Not because ancient Hebrews took a literary theory class and decided chiasms are the way to go, but because chiasms reflect how ancients thought and communicated. Which leads to the key observation about chiasms. Why are they real? If it's not a matter of ingenuity or literary theory merely, which is where most of our biblical critic friends are content. Well, as the scholarship has, I think, demonstrated quite helpfully, it appears chiasms, the chiasmus, developed as a way to make narratives and other kinds of literature memorable. This is an aid to memorization and to recall. The chiasm is a servant. The chiasm is there to help you, as it was there to help ancient Hebrew children being read and taught Torah day and night and day and night, and hearing Torah read routinely, regularly, weekly, especially annually, in festivals and feasts. If we remember, in fact, that biblical text is not given to us with modern journalistic goals, though it has journalistic value, but is given as an ecclesiastical text to shape liturgical and ritual life for Israelites, to form them to live in light of their liturgical feasts and festivals, and to remember the events of God's mighty deliverance and his provision as they are going through the ritual, the liturgical year, and remember certain events that we lined up with that. If this is a liturgical text, it makes all the sense in the world that it's written with a view to being recalled. The chiasm is an expression of divine love for you. He doesn't want to make this more difficult than he has to be. The Lord is not interested in giving us some wonderfully exciting, entertaining Sherlockian puzzle to decode as we make our way passage through passage thinking, ooh, 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 what might this detail mean? Perhaps we will learn in time what the detail means, but the first step is actually to remember it as we keep reading. Remember it. The chiasms are there to aid memory, recall, which is why type scenes are so important. The repetition of certain features makes you think, haven't I been here before? Stop me if I've told this story before, except you can't stop. You got to keep reading and hear the story again. That's what the chiasm is there for. What then do we notice in with respect to the chiasm in Joseph's story? Well, the parallel of Judah's experience in chapter 38 with what's called his character transformation in chapter 44 sets us up for appreciating that the transformation of Judah from what he was to what he will be, the transformation of Judah by way of his experience with Tamar, is what ultimately will make possible the 12 tribes of Israel. By way of the reconciliation and reunion between Joseph and his other brothers. The Joseph story was actually part of a story being told about Judah's transformation. And the role of Judah at the end of Joseph's story, chapter 44, in reconciling the brothers, making possible their move as a tribe, their move as a family, reunited in this way, which becomes the settlement of the 12 tribes of Israel. And who is right there in the middle as the foil for it all, the instigator for it all, who is the hinge between the Judah that was and the Judah that will be? Who is the agent in the divine hand for the kind of conversion of Judah? Tamar. Now, along these lines, I'd like us to note some features of the text that aid us in appreciating some of these elements. When we compare D in our literary structure to D with the stroke, a comparison exquisitely demonstrates the elaborate ingenuity of the author. At first sight, matching these two would seem unlikely, but in reality, it shows itself to be quite deliberate. They are both exclusively about Judah. D is dealing with Judah and Tamar, D with the stroke, D1, if you will, consisting of a lengthy, touching speech by Judah. A lengthy, touching speech. Thus, they differ in genre, but also, but in theme and content, they actually have many elements in common, many meaningful, beautiful words occurring in both units. Both of them brought side by side, but not like any other text in the passage, refer at the same time to wife, bearing, son, brother, surety, remaining, and on the list could go. While in D, on the front end, Judah is deeply concerned with the fact that his youngest son Shelah may die, mote, like his brothers, in 38:11, in D1, it is Judah who speaks of his father Jacob's concern about Benjamin. His brother is dead, Judah says. He alone is left, 44:20. In short, Judah's experience, and this is what I'd like to leave with you to wrestle with, Judah's experience of the deaths of his two sons in connection with Tamar's provoking him to deal with his responsibilities seems to have transformed him. This conjecture turns out to be correct as we analyze this match further. Before this, Judah is a hard and a callous man. He's the one who suggests selling Joseph, probably plays the leading role in deceiving his father Jacob. Now, on the other side of Tamar, into chapter 44, in this grand moving speech, which in its own way changes the world within the context of the Pentateuch, now he's transformed into a caring person, deeply concerned with his old father, Jacob. Speaking about his father and the urgency of brotherly reconciliation from the experience of one who has lost two sons as well. The reader assumes this pathos on Judah's part in chapter 44 must have come from the same experiences that Judah and his father, Jacob, underwent. Both lose a son or sons, and both lose a wife. Both are deceived in the same way, Jacob by his sons, Judah by a daughter-in-law. On the front half of our chiasm, indeed, Judah's wife bears three sons and two die. One is left, and his wife also dies. In D1, Jacob's wife bears two sons. One dies, one is left, and his wife also dies. in how Judah tells the story. In D, Judah says to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he feared that he too would die like his brothers." Verse 11, 38. On the contrary, it's D1, it is Judah who wants to remain as a slave himself in place of Benjamin. Formerly, Judah tries to abandon Tamar, dispense with her. Now he's willing to be abandoned on behalf of his brother Benjamin. Indeed, Judah forsakes his words that he promised to give his son Shelah to Tamar. So Tamar deceives him, urges his pledge, and so on. In D1, Judah is willing to give himself as the pledge to save his brother Benjamin. And the very wording, pledge and become a pledge, occur only in these sections of Genesis, these parallel sections, always in association with Judah. It's most likely that Judah's transformation is closely associated with his observation of his father's long-suffering over the loss of Joseph. Within 17 verses in D1, chapter 44, 18 to 34, within 17 verses, the word father appears 14 times. A father, my father, our father, his father. The density of the occurrence of the word father in Judah's moving speech clearly indicates Judah has fully perceived his father's unrelieved grief at the loss of his son Joseph, and is deeply concerned now more about Jacob than he is about himself. All this suggesting Judah has changed, and the two units are actually related in order to signal that change. The meaning of this intended match is well summarized by Gordon Wenham. He doesn't talk about the chiasm, but he describes the parallel this way. "What a different Judah," he says, "we meet in chapter 44. Here he appeals for Benjamin's release with great warmth and tenderness, describing with great love his father's suffering since Joseph's disappearance and foreseeing his sorrowful death if Benjamin is not allowed to return to Canaan. He concludes by offering to stay as a slave in place of Benjamin. Clearly, Judah is a changed man, and this story shows the beginning of the transformation when he admits, 'She's right, not I.' Without this account," he goes on to say, Wenham, "without this account of Tamar putting her father-in-law to shame, we should be hard-pressed to explain the change in his character. And in its biographical sketches, character change is what Genesis is all about. Abram becomes Abraham. Jacob becomes Israel. Particularly in Jacob's family, we see examples of character change. Reuben, violator of his father's concubine, later shows great concern for both Joseph and his father, while the upstart Joseph becomes a wise statesman forgiving his brothers. Wenham says this chapter has a most important role in clarifying the course of the subsequent narrative. Without it, we should find its development inexplicable." Indeed, it's the case. It's apparent that without Genesis 38, the full transformation of Judah's character in chapter 44 can't be explained. So Genesis 38 is closely connected not only with what goes before and immediately follows it, 39, but also later Genesis 44 as its matching unit. This transformation of Judah touches the heart of Joseph, making possible the reconciliation and reunion between Joseph and the other brothers. We notice in the chiasm what the center is. The center, the mountain peak, is the report that Joseph finally rises to power in chapter 41. Joseph's real authority, we note in this passage, in this context, is expressed with special objects and special terms: a signet ring, garments of fine linen, a gold chain around his neck, his chariot, and a special shout before him. Bow the knee, and so on, chapter 41. Perhaps the fact that there's a gold chain around his neck here is what led the psalmist in Psalm 105, which was read before Gary's first talk yesterday, to say something about Joseph's imprisonment Genesis doesn't say. Look at it sometime, but in Psalm 105, I think it's around verse 22, there is a description of Joseph in prison, that he is, his neck is chained, his feet are sore in pain. There's a description of him in the stocks and wearing a collar, a chain collar around his neck. It's not in Genesis at all. The passage referred to in your cross references only says he is thrown in prison. The psalmist is describing a scene. Why might he do that? This is one reason why the psalmist might infer from the glory of his exalted state what something of what was involved in his humiliated state. That as he has a gold chain around the neck now, it's a full reversal of the prison chain he had around his neck as a collar earlier. We do note along these lines the fact that he is donning garments of fine linen now. That too proves to be quite significant. In the Joseph story, however, we continue along the earlier line, the transformation of Judah from a cruel executioner, Genesis 38, to a warm protector in chapter 44 is what makes possible the reconciliation and reunion between Joseph and his brothers. Without that change in Judah, there's no reconciliation. Without reconciliation and reunion, we have no final portrait of this family, of the Israel consisting of 12 tribes on the way in and out of Genesis into the rest of Scripture. Through this structural observation, it's readily apparent that the Joseph story has a preparatory function for the next story. The role of Joseph is to preserve a remnant on earth and keep alive many survivors for Israel, chapter 45, 5-7. That is what is reaffirmed to Jacob in the only divine vision in the whole Joseph story, and the last one in the book of Genesis, chapter 46, verse 3. I am El, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I shall make you into a great nation there. The main theme of the next story, from 46:28 to 50:26, that final word that ostensibly is about Joseph's last days, is actually the theme of the formation of the nation Israel, which up until this scene, technically up until Tamar, was tribes, clans, and families. But as a result of the promise given to Jacob that closes the book of Genesis, becomes what we call the nation Israel. The Judah-Tamar story, therefore, matching with Judah's appeal, signals that all the matching elements we've summarized focus on Judah's character transformation and plays the role of a touchstone to demonstrate the change of the brothers, which makes all the future of the story possible. Without the two Judah sections, we don't have the reasons for the reconciliation and reunion. Without the reconciliation, we don't have the 12 tribes coming into being together. Without Genesis 38, the main storyline and theme of the Joseph story, which is pushing toward Judah and Israel, simply does not stand. However, as we reflect a bit more on Joseph in the canon as a whole, we notice that Joseph's love from his father, which I have suggested in my opening remarks, has meaning of everything significance in its ultimate form in the father's love for the son. So noticing the profound depths of the father's love for the son in the story, we notice it takes the form of a coat. And of course, the coat has had a life of its own in the tradition and in popular Christianity. And I'd like us to pause a bit over the coat. But on the way in, we want to remember what we have just learned about Joseph's exaltation. And that is that Joseph's story is in fact a story of two coats. A story of two garments. The first is the coat he is given by his beloved father, his loving father, doting father, the coat that would be soaked or drenched in goat's blood as a signal or symbol of his death. That would, on its own, as a bloody coat, identify Joseph and persuade his father of his death. The other coat, the other garments, we noted, are described in connection with his exaltation. And that is the linen garments, the gleaming garments that are of a royal status. He has been given a position of power and authority, and one of the symbols attached to that new state or status for Joseph is his other coat. A bloody coat and then a gleaming one, a white one, a linen one, a royal one. What about that first coat, the coat that was given from his father? Well, the nature of Joseph's coat of many colors, which is how the King James Version, Authorized Version, rendered it, the nature of Joseph's coat of many colors, mentioned in Genesis 37, verses 3 and 23 and 32, has in fact long been a topic of scholarly discussion, but then of course everything has been. But this too has been a topic of long scholarly discussion. The Hebrew phrase, as you see on the backside of your sheet, the Hebrew phrase, ketona pasim, is in fact quite unusual. The first element is fairly straightforward. The ketona pasim, the ketona referring to the garment, just a well-attested Hebrew word meaning garment. It's used in Genesis 3, Exodus 28 several times, Exodus 29, 39, 40. Just within the Pentateuch, there are many, many references to this ordinary garment vocabulary word. It's the second element, the pasim, ha-pasim, that's a lot more difficult. It's traditionally or typically understood as a plural cal-type noun with an article attached. There's a rather long, I think quite interesting, but few others would agree, story to tell about likely roots, relationship to similar roots in Akkadian and Aramaic and some other, Ugaritic especially, other roots that I won't go into today in order to focus on the connections we'd like to notice. The term, importantly, however, this term is only attested here in the Joseph story, again, Genesis 37, 3, 23, and 32, only here in the Joseph story and in one other place, and only one other place, 2 Samuel 13, 18 to 19, read earlier. That's where it appears once again as part of the same phrase, same descriptor. Now, the Septuagint of Genesis rendered the phrase, at least, you know, the Septuagint isn't one thing, and all of our Septuagint scholars in the room are nodding with appreciation. It's not just one thing. There are a couple, you know, there are often interesting disagreements, Leningrad and other versions of the Septuagint. The Septuagint of Genesis renders the phrase keton poikilos. That's where we get multicolored garment, apparently connecting an Aramaic word for strip or stripe to this Hebrew form. The Greek translators of Samuel, however, opt for keton karpotos, garment reaching to the wrist. That's one Septuagint reading. Or keton astragalotos, garment, this is a length consideration, reaching to the ankle, garment reaching to the ankle, the other Septuagintal text evidence, in this case assuming a connection to another Aramaic word meaning palm, the palm of one's hand, used in Daniel 5, verse 5. There are a few other creative suggestions out there. Biblical scholars lack nothing in creativity. Spicer links the term to an Akkadian root. Mendenhall links it to an Ugaritic root. Today, most scholars follow the example of most of the Greek translators of Samuel and understand pasim as referring to either the palms of the hand or the soles, in particular to the extremities in general, human extremities. In either case, it means something, according to the majority now, means something like a long-sleeved garment, a long-sleeved garment. Most scholarly treatments opt for something like that. You'll see long-sleeved coat, or something like that. However, as is often the case, and why you should always ask one more question when you hear this is what the scholarly consensus is that in this case, as in many others, the consensus is based less on the convincing nature of the argument itself, that it's a foolproof argument without any contrary evidence. It's not based on that so much as the fact that there isn't a better alternative out there, and so until we find a better one, we're going to content ourselves with this. And that's okay. We do that in all the time in life. That's what even the hard sciences often look like, and this is no exception. Well, what might we learn if we look a bit closely at the other example of this expression that's found in 2 Samuel? It's common for everyone to focus their attention on Joseph and his really special coat, but there's good reason for beginning instead with the other occurrence in the passage we read today, the Tamar and Amnon story in 2 Samuel 13. Why is it better to look there, perhaps strategically more effective to do so? Well, unlike in the Joseph narrative, in this only other time the expression occurs, which should give us caution anyway about concluding too much, but in the only other time it occurs, it comes, thankfully, with an explanation. It comes with a, and this is what this is, a side statement. Unlike the Joseph narrative, it's provided with an explicit description of the garment's purpose. You'll notice the language here for 2 Samuel 13, 18, the first part. Now she had on, this is the New American Standard Bible, just I needed to choose one. The New American Standard Bible does a pretty good job with being wooden, sometimes at the expense of being readable, but there we are. Now she had on, it says in this case, a long-sleeved garment. Now notice the next expression. For in this way, in this manner, the virgin daughters of the king dressed themselves in robes. The clause that follows the same vocabulary in Hebrew is explaining that clause. And this is something that happens often in Old Testament narrative, especially Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. The reader is learning something that the author, the writer, is not utterly confident they would immediately know. For whatever reason, and we can speculate endlessly about why, but for whatever reason, maybe some time has passed, or the traditions have changed, or where the writing is going, it's not the local tradition, but for whatever reason, the writer is assuming the readers would benefit from a description of why these garments are worn at all. And so the reader is being informed that the garment's primary function, again, the only other use of this Hebrew expression, the garment's primary function was to indicate the status of, in this case, a royal daughter, but to indicate something particular about this royal daughter. Her sexual status, not in the narrow sense of sexual, but in the cultic sense. Her status as virginal and pure with all that is attached to that status, or married, or defiled, or whatever the case may be, other than that virginal pure state. This indicates that the one who dons the garb, the one who is wearing the robe, is someone enjoying the status of the virginal royal, in this case, daughter. We notice then what happens in the wake of Amnon's rape. What does she do? In her grief, she dramatically rends the garment. Why? Well, she no longer qualifies as the virginal daughter of the king. And in her grief, she rends the garment, which says as much. The scribe, the writer, is apparently not fully certain his audience will know the cultural and cultic significance of the garment mentioned in verse 19, so he adds this explanation for his readers in advance. In fact, if you look at the Hebrew, and this is also clear in the Septuagintal Greek, if you look at it, it's clumsy enough in the sense that it seems like it's deliberately being put in there, that critical scholars have concluded, obviously this was added eons later to say something that the original text did not say, when in, yes, that maybe that's possible, a more straightforward explanation is that much as I am doing as I speak and as you would do when you're writing, if you think it helpful to explain something, you say it and then you pause and give your clarifying remark and keep talking, which is all that's necessary here. Regarding the use of an item of clothing to mark social and sexual status, we do find a striking parallel, the scholars have noted, in Middle Assyrian laws, among which are stipulations about which kinds of women can be veiled. I won't go into that evidence, except to just throw out to you as an interesting aside that outside the Old Testament writings themselves, and not excluded by what we do have in 2 Samuel, is that this garment functioned very much like a veil. It was called, in fact, in shorthand, the veiling of the royal daughter. The veiling of her was when she wore this distinguishing robe. The parallel is interesting for many reasons. Here are two. First of all, Tamar's garment is explicitly connected to her marital and social status in verse 18. As the writer has told us, this is how virgin daughters of the king dress themselves, telling us something of her status and socially and in marriage. Something the daughters of the king who are virgins wear, but only so long as they are in that status of virginity. It's unclear from our text and from the evidence we have, unclear who other than virgin daughters of a king might be eligible to wear this Hebrew expression in Israel, referring to the robe. Would wives of the king worn it? Maybe. We don't know. It's not told to us. What we are told is that this is something you should expect only pure virginal daughters, royal daughters, to be wearing. The brief gloss in verse 18 doesn't tell us one way or the other, which is no surprise because it's irrelevant to the story of why Tamar herself is wearing one. It is noteworthy, though, that the two types of women who are explicitly excluded from wearing a veil in Middle Assyrian laws were prostitutes and concubines, women whose sexual status was viewed as inferior to full wives and virgin daughters. In the Samuel Tamar's case, Amnon's rape had likewise altered her sexual status from more to less respectable, or from superior to inferior, from virgin to violated under the circumstances. It also, I won't go down this path today, but also suggests we should maybe think again canonically about the way Tamar chooses to disclose, to obscure her identity, and that's by way of the veiling, but that also has other significance beyond our purposes. The similarity, as I noted, becomes even more striking when you observe that the verb used in reference to veiling in the Middle Assyrian laws is phonetically very similar to our problematic Hebrew expression, suggesting, as some have, there's the same root in view. If what we have suggested so far is at least basically sound, and we're being suggestive on things we can't be sure about, and the type of garment that Tamar is wearing in Samuel marks her virginity and her royal status, and the obvious question is, what on earth is Joseph doing wearing one in Genesis chapter 37? Especially since it's rather unlikely that there are two different garments called by this unusual name mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, especially when one of them explains the garment in a way that signals its special status within Israel, its recognized status. Having two with this unusual name that would be both present in the Hebrew Bible and have this enjoyed public status and recognized status, but mean actually completely different things, is at least very difficult to assume as true. Many scholars in response have alleged that the reason there is one in Genesis 37 is because the writer is frankly a bit careless. It's a later scribal gloss that is deliberately trying to connect the Joseph story to the later story of Tamar and Amnon. In fact, this is the assumption of why there is a Tamar at all in Genesis. It's because there is a Tamar and an Amnon in the Samuel story, which is so key to our understanding of the Davidic dynasty. It's far more likely, I think, at least, that the Tamar named in Samuel is named Tamar because the Tamar of Genesis history enjoyed a positive reputation, and as is the case in other names in the Old Testament, parents named their daughter Tamar as a show of respect for the Tamar of old. The link would go far beyond the name, however, as one of the reasons people suggest a link, critical scholars, is because on a close reading there is a great deal in common textually between 2 Samuel and Genesis, the Genesis Joseph account. The critical assumption is that this is because Genesis is written from the perspective of Samuel and in dependence upon Samuel. I think the same evidence could just as well prove the contrary, that Samuel, the Samuel text describing the Davidic dynasty, in keeping with the concerns for the line of Judah throughout the Old Testament, is perhaps reflecting upon the way the Judah story is told and informed appropriately in that direction. As I mentioned, the phrase in question occurs three times in Genesis 37. First, when Joseph gives Joseph the garment, then when his brothers strip it from him, and then finally when his brothers dip it in blood and bring it to Jacob, who recognizes it as Joseph's. In addition, the word for the robe itself, the garment, the word garment, that is, appears five other times. Once in verse 23 of Genesis 37, three times when describing the same scene of the brothers dipping the coat and so on, but those are not terribly important. Despite the fact that the garment first appears in verse 3, and despite what many televised and popular versions of the Joseph story would suggest, this robe really plays no real role in the story until verse 23, when the brothers take it from him in order to deceive their father. What we read in 37:3 is that Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his brothers because he was the son of his old age, and he made for him this robe. Right after that, verse 4, we read that his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, and they hated him. We can assume that it's the gift of the robe that occasions Joseph's brothers' hatred. But that's never explicitly stated, or at least, while it may have occasioned it, the robe doesn't seem to be the fixture on the part of the brothers, but only what the robe and many other things presumably represented or expressed, the special love of the father for this son. That love appears to be the instigating factor. So later in the narrative, we read that the brothers take the garment, slaughter a male goat, dip the garment in blood, bring the garment to the father and say, "Isn't this your son's?" And he replies, the father does, "The garment of my son." The function the garment plays, on the one hand, is expressive of the love of the father, and on the far end of the story, at this point of the story, is to convince Jacob Joseph has died. The narrative itself in no way requires, then, that it's seen as a special coat itself. But unlike the Tamar narrative, the way Joseph's garment is described does not yet seem to be extra special. But then the canonical reader keeps reading. And after Samuel has extensively linked itself up to the Judah story and the Joseph story more generally, we come upon this term in the Tamar Amnon story and wonder, boy, the only other time that occurs is back when the Judah story is being told, when the Joseph story is being told as the Judah story. Might there be some significance in this special garment? We could pause to note all the close literary connections between the Tamar stories of the Hebrew Bible, as many have. But instead, what I'd like us to do is to take what we have learned so far and think as canonical readers of the possibilities for a Christian reading, not only of Joseph and his coat, but more particularly of the Judah story being told by way of it in connection with Tamar. Along the way, what I'm asking us to do is what I suggested at the outset. Read as though we believe the end illuminates the meaning of all things prior and preliminary to it. That the light that shines brightly at the end of our story, as it is a given certainty in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, a sure thing that is coming to us as we are going to it, that light illuminates the meaningfulness of everything leading up to it. What are the possibilities here? Well, we note that the coat communicates royal status, purity, and glory. I remember the words of a now deceased, gone to be with the Lord, Old Testament professor of mine at Westminster, a greatly beloved, godly man, Al Groves, who began, it seems, not just every class, but every section of his lectures with this reminder, there are no free motifs. There are no free motifs, by which he meant there are no motifs that are actually there in the Bible that are there accidentally, that are there suspended by nothing, attached to nothing. They're there accidentally as human artifice. No, the Lord who wrote this word doesn't waste his words. There are no free motifs. Well, let's ask these questions then. Why does beloved and favored Joseph have such a coat? In the context of Judah's story, if we're now persuaded Judah is at least as much a part of the story as Joseph, in the context of Judah's story, given what Judah's story will be canonically, given the special, unique significance of Judah canonically, does the light of the end of Judah cast any light on why Joseph has such a coat? Well, what is Judah's story for, ultimately? Where is it going, ultimately? Of course, this is directly connected to the nature of the royal status of the Lion of the tribe of Judah, none other than the Lord Jesus Christ, who is in view precisely as king and leader of his people. Why does Tamar in 2 Samuel have such a coat, have such a robe, in the context of King David's story, playing a subordinate but very important role in the development and unraveling, in fact, of David's royal story? Well, what is David's story for, ultimately? Yet again, we're driven along very much the same path as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Who is the one who sits on David's throne? Is there any sense in which this is his story as well, in an important way, and that the robe once again figures as it communicates royal status and purity to one who belongs to this royal reality? Why does undeserved family violence figure in the only two uses of this coat image or vocabulary in the Old Testament? Well, again, we step back and ask the question, what role does undeserved family violence have biblically, ultimately? Where does it reappear and with great power and pathos? Is it not, in fact, one of the primary environments in which the gospel writers tell us to interpret the nature of Jesus' rejection, suffering, and eventually his crucifixion? He came into his own, and his own received him not. As we think with the grain of the canon in this way, I suggest other questions are prompted. First, as we cast our glance backwards to Eve, is the Eve of Genesis 2 herself Adam's royal, pure, glorious robe? In 1 Corinthians 11:7, the apostle says, as an aside, evidently reflecting on the Genesis narrative and applying it, man, husband, he says, is the image and glory of God, but woman or wife is the glory of man. We remember the Eastern tradition of the church, which has read Adam and Eve particularly as expressive of a glorious luminescence belonging to their royal status, which would be followed by their skinned humiliation. And while there are many features of this, I would rather leave to the side and suggest we should not follow, there are some things they are sensitive to in ways we might learn to be as well. Notice as well, when we come to Song of Songs, which ancient interpreters regarded as the Holy of Holies of the Old Testament, the Leviticus of the later writings, the Holy Sanctum Sanctorum of Torah, of the scriptures, that at the center, in fact, of this central book, there is a dramatic scene from chapter 3, verse 6, that extends to chapter 4, verse 1, when a scene is described as a royal parade, and the bystanders, those who stand by, are saying, "Look, look, behold the litter or the couch of Solomon." And then there's a moving chapter-long description of the extraordinary glory of this royal figure, this Solomon. And then as chapter 4:1 starts, we actually haven't changed scenes, as many scholars have noted, and instead what it is Solomon turning to the bystander and we learn only then that this description has not been Solomon as such, but Solomon's bride, Solomon's beloved, the royal queenly figure, has been described as the glory of the king. To refer to acknowledge, to appreciate her glory is to appreciate his actual glory, which is in her, to be found in her. Is the church the ascended Christ's royal, pure, glorious robe? For the greater Joseph, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, do we not read in Revelation chapter 19, verses 6 to 8, of his bride's linen, fine and pure? And the costliness of enjoying this royal status, the military warfare victory that was required, and learn in verses 11 to 16 specifically of a robe dipped in blood, in what seems a clear recall of Joseph's blood. A reminder to us as well that the next and central time, the central time Israel would be confronted with goat's blood would be where? In its regular life as a people. Over and over and over on the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16, as the blood of the goat is involved in the cultic sacrifices for that special day. The association of goat's blood with cultic sacrifice to render the people of God clean for access to God without condemnation, for enjoying the blessings, the shalom of his presence. The connection of goat blood and the robe dipped in blood in Joseph's story seems to reappear here at the end. And then finally, in 21 verses 9 to 14, the bridal motherly figure, the one who is the very beloved of the Lord, his glory is none other than her. She is the glory of the Lamb. All this to suggest that while there are no free motifs, and while these are canonical possibilities I'm suggesting for your further investigation, the way Genesis 38 is located within the Joseph narrative suggests we might see Tamar as Joseph's robed counterpart. Not within Genesis itself yet, but as we read and reread and reread again Genesis, as we read into 2 Samuel, and the robed Tamar there, who in her own way becomes the agent for the story of David as a whole. What I've aimed to do then is to offer suggestive possibilities for lines worth pursuing, but in all of this to communicate that the Lord is not giving us a Sherlockian puzzle to decode. He gives us his word in wisdom, but also in love. And he structures it not to give us something to do on our Mondays. He gives it to us so that we might remember. And remembering his words, believe it. And believing his words, expect the fulfillment of it in our own glory, in union with Jesus Christ.